Warning, this episode contains descriptions of graphic violence. If you are sensitive to this type of material, you might entertain the idea of skipping this episode. We would consider this episode to be inappropriate for any listener under the age of 16. We here at Defense Diaries believe firmly that we have an ethical obligation as podcasters and storytellers who are firmly entrenched in the true crime genre to always remember and acknowledge with great respect the victims whose heartbreaking and tragic tales we have chosen to recount. We made the conscious decision when we started this podcast with the Gacy case to memorialize the victims as opposed to glorify the monster. And Darren and I feel that we accomplished that. With the Tunnel Vision season, as I represented Anthony Garcia in his trial as his defense counsel, I have been presented with the challenge of making sure that you, despite my role in the trial and in representing Anthony Garcia, have an absolute understanding that I, too, desire justice for the victims. If this concept seems counterintuitive to you as you sit and think, how can that be? If I'm representing the man accused of killing those four innocent souls, well, it's a fair question. The answer, however, is fairly straightforward and is answered as such, that in order for there to be what we consider to be justice done for the victims of violent crimes, both sides, the defense and the prosecution, must endeavor to persevere that the right person has been arrested, charged, and ultimately convicted. Do they have the guy? After all, that is the entire purpose of a trial, to put that question to the test. As we have told you, there are movies and books and TV which are all fictionalized. And then there's reality. And reality is that a majority of criminal cases never go to trial for a myriad of reasons. And if a case does in fact go to trial, the reason is because there is a real question of guilt. Sure, there are cases which proceed to trial where the answer in terms of the evidence seems evident that they have the guy. I've even tried those cases. But for the vast majority that do go all the way to trial, that is simply not the case. So the evidence has to be vetted, the witnesses questioned, the theory of the case tested vigorously. Because without these things taking place, we can never know. The victims' families can never know if, in fact, justice has been served. So when I go into a case like Garcia, where my client always professed his innocence, I owe him a duty to test the state's case and evidence as zealously as humanly possible. And that duty extends to the victims and their families as well. Because if the wrong person is convicted, no one, and I mean no one, has received justice. If you ever have any questions regarding my earnestness with respect to the victims while we retell these terrible sagas. So Darren and I have been exceptionally cognizant of the fact that these are not stories that we are telling, but instead are gut-wrenching, heartbreaking recounts of the worst days of these victims and their families' lives. And that thought never leaves my mind as I write, ever. Treating the victims and their surviving family members with the utmost respect is of paramount concern to both Darren and I. And when I am presented with the challenge of describing what happened on these awful days in which these innocent souls drew their respective final breaths, I do everything in my power to do it in such a way so as not to sensationalize or diminish the horror of what we are telling you. I feel that we have accomplished what we are so diligently attempting to accomplish. If at the moment you listen to these final moments of any of these human beings' lives, that you were filled not with shock and horror, but instead with dread and sadness and anger and wonder aloud, why? We are trying to place you in the victim's shoes, in the family's shoes, trying to accomplish the impossible which is to give you some sense of what those final moments very well might have been like for these people. So as we progress through the senseless and brutal homicides of Mary and Roger Brumbeck, and if you find yourselves comparing how we handled this crime with how we handled the killings of Thomas Hunter and Shirley Sherman, where we left you to imagine their final moments instead of describing them. Because in order to memorialize both Thomas and Shirley, there was simply no reason to describe the killings themselves. None. With Mary Brumbeck in particular, I feel that we will best honor her, her memory, and her final moments on this mortal coil by describing the absolutely heroic battle for her life that she put forth. When we got this case, I wept as I read through her autopsy report, as it contained within its description of the wounds she sustained, just exactly how hard she fought to save her husband's and her own life. I was overwhelmed then, as I am now, at the otherworldly courage that she displayed in the face of absolute brutality. It was a battle for life that deserves to be memorialized and acknowledged. And we are going to do so in the most poignant way possible, because nothing encapsulates Mary Brumbeck's indomitable will to live so that she could continue to enjoy her children, her grandchildren, her husband, those she donated her time to help, her life, more than Mary's last stand. Welcome to Defense Diaries. I'm your host, Bob Mata, and this is episode 25. The intruder hears nothing other than the steady, piercing tone pulsating in his eardrums. His breathing is labored as he sucks in huge amounts of air, attempting to gain control of his heart rate, which is racing beyond anything that he's ever experienced. His eyes are fixated on the man lying on the floor in front of him. He can see the man's chest slowly rising and falling, rising and falling. His labored breathing is evident from the small bubbles of blood forming and then popping on his lips. Blood slowly and steadily pools around his body. He's still alive. His mouth is moving as if he's saying something. The intruder can't make out the words over the ringing in his ears. Roger's staring at the foyer ceiling. His life is slipping away. He can feel it. Breathing seems an impossible task. With whatever strength he has left, he pushes two words out of his diaphragm. Whether or not they are audible, he does not know. Mary, run! Mary stumbles back a step as she stands suddenly from the table after the first shot rings out. The chair teeters yet doesn't topple. A second shot rings out, followed instantaneously by a third shot or fourth. She doesn't know. She doesn't care. It's not computing. Nothing is. She can't see Roger from where she stands. She doesn't know if he's injured or far worse. She stays silent, listening for any sounds, for any signs of life. She cautiously moves towards the dishwasher and silently pulls it open. She knows that there's a kitchen knife in the top rack. She pulls the rack halfway out and grabs the knife that she had placed there earlier in the day. She looks up at the rear entrance. It's right there. She might be able to make it. The thought of running to save her own life, to leave her husband behind, is fleeting. And then gone. Her heart is pounding. Her breathing shallow and rapid. She feels the knife in her right hand, empowering her. She changes her grip to overhand and raises her right arm to a 90-degree angle. The knife is at the ready. She is ready. She slowly moves out of the kitchen towards the living room. One step at a time. Stealthily moving forward, one silent footfall after another. She peeks around the corner of the wall that blocks the view of the foyer from the kitchen and gasps. She places her left hand over her mouth to stifle any more sound from coming out. She sees Roger laying on the floor. He's bleeding, but breathing. She hears him make a sound. It's words. No louder than a whisper. Harry, run. The skin of her face feels as if it's on fire. She has shifted from terrified to enraged in the blink of an eye. She has never in her entire life felt what she is feeling at this exact moment in time. No. I'm not running anywhere, she thinks. He's still alive. She cannot see anyone standing near her husband. She has a clear view of the front door just beyond where Roger is lying. The door is swung all the way open. The storm is closed. Is it possible he never came in? She thinks. Could he have shot Roger from outside the house and run? Like the coward he is? She doesn't know. But she doesn't think so. She can sense that there's someone, something in her home. She can feel it in her bones. Whoever did this is still here. The intruder had heard her. Before he opened the front door, he heard a woman's voice. She is in here, but where? The stairway leading to the second floor is directly in front of him. They lead straight down to the foyer. Could she be upstairs? Yes, of course she can. She could be anywhere. She may have escaped. There has to be a back door. That would be fine. She never saw me, I think. I can't hear anything. It's ringing. She doesn't know that. He takes a step back into the living room. It's just to the left of the foyer. He's still looking at the man on the floor. He hasn't moved. He can't move. He's dying. Mary moves quietly with two quick steps past the staircase, which leads down to both the foyer and the back hallway. She lowers the knife and pokes her head out from behind the living room wall. She sees him. His back is facing the dining room. He's looking at Roger. Her heart is thumping in her chest. She is overcome with a primal rage. She has never experienced such an uncompromised feeling of knowing what she must do in a moment. This moment is everything. It is life, or it is death. There will be no in-between, not on this day. The time for thinking has passed. Mary feels no fear, none at all. As a matter of fact, she feels nothing. There is no doubt, no second thoughts. She raises the knife once again and charges toward the intruder, letting out a guttural roar the likes of which can only come from deep within one's soul, pure, unadulterated savagery. The intruder hears the primal scream in spite of his compromised hearing. He spins around clumsily and sees her racing towards him with a knife held high above her head, more than ready to kill him. He does not have time to fire the gun because she is upon him. He is able to parry her first attempt at stabbing him with his right forearm, the same arm which holds the 9mm. He blocks her first attack. She pulls the knife back and once again brings the knife down towards him with all of the might her 5'6" frame can muster. But before it hits flesh, suddenly, with a blast of instant crippling pain and a blinding flash of white light that seems as if it's her brain resetting, she is struck in the right side of her forehead with what feels like a hammer. She is stunned and stumbles backwards unevenly, but she doesn't go down. But she can't tell if she's still holding on to the knife. She's disoriented and backs into a heavy wooded chair, which takes out her left leg, causing her to fall to the ground. The intruder feels lucky that she didn't bury the knife in his chest. She rears back her arm to take another shot at him with the blade. And with a short, forceful movement, he claps the right side of her forehead with the butt of his gun. It's a significant blow, which causes the magazine of his weapon to eject. She's screaming as she stumbles backwards. The clutter of a living room in the early stages of a move to West Virginia causes her to lose her balance and go down. He can't determine if she still has the knife. He races from where she originally appeared and quickly finds the kitchen. He rips open the first drawer he sees. It's a junk drawer. He screams, "Fuck!" As he jerks open the drawer next to it, he eyes a brown-handled kitchen knife and grabs it. He immediately turns back and heads towards where he left her. She watches him leave the room. Her vision is blurred by both the violent blow to the head and the blood from the wound as it streams down her forehead into her eyes. Stings. She gets to one knee and attempts to steady herself, to once again rise to her feet in order to continue to fight this unwelcomed invader that has entered their home. She sees him appear once again, like a grim specter, wielding one of her own knives as he has walked down the hall leading from the kitchen to the foyer. She's able to rise to her feet and steady herself. She no longer is holding the knife that she once held. She attempts to wipe the blood from her eyes with the back of her wrist. It does little to improve her vision as the open wound on her forehead continues to gush blood. She has no chance to locate her weapon as the intruder suddenly closes in on her. She knows at this point that she has no other option than to try and disarm her attacker. She readies herself as he bears down on her. The intruder looks at the bloodied and battered warrior that stands in front of him. "It's not supposed to go this way. I'm in no condition for a knife fight." He is at least 100 pounds on this woman, but she is fearless. And she has nothing to lose and everything to gain. She's lost her knife, but overtaking her is a daunting task. Knife fights are vicious. She's screaming like a wild banshee, and she looks possessed. She is possessed. She's seen me. I simply cannot leave her alive. With that, he moves in. Mary will not be waiting for this son of a bitch to reach her. Instead, she lunges toward the armed intruder that is twice her size. She tries to grab his right arm with both of her hands, the arm with which he wields the blade, in order to try and wrestle it away from him. She's able to capture his forearm. He strikes her face with a balled-up left fist. She remains undeterred and continues to hang onto his limb. She can feel his hot, putrid breath on her face as she's crashed her body sideways into his protruding gut in order to create leverage to work the knife free from his hand. She grabs the blade of the knife with her right hand, closing her fist around it, oblivious to the pain. She pounds on the intruder's right hand with her closed left fist, trying to force the weapon's release. She just can't jar it loose. But instead, he rips his right arm back, pulling the knife free from Mary's grip, nearly severing her thumb. Mary screams, not in anguish, but rather in seething anger. She swings wildly at the man's face with all of the power she can muster. It seems to have little effect on this intruder as he pushes her back with his left hand and begins wildly thrusting the knife towards Mary's face with a backhanded motion. The vicious attack is parried by Mary as she uses her forearm to shield her face from the bloody tip of the blade. Mary's blood-curdling screams fill the room as she desperately continues to somehow disarm the madman, who appears obsessively intent on ending her life. The intruder is shocked by the amount of strength this woman possesses. He's exhausted, is gasping for air. If this doesn't end soon, he may very well end up on the losing end of this knife fight. It's clear to him that this woman's will to live is greater than his desire to end her life. He desperately fights to pull his arm from her grasp as she's pounding on his right hand with her fist. She has a hold of the knife blade, fighting to gain control of the weapon. Why didn't she run when she had the chance? Mary is running on fumes. She has never felt this level of exhaustion, even during the birth of her children. Her will to live is supplying whatever remaining energy she has left. She simply has no way to stop the never-ending series of violent thrusts this monster keeps producing. He's gasping for air, and it just won't stop. He won't stop. Why? She doesn't have the strength to push him away from her, to disengage, to allow her to grab something, anything, to strike him with. She feels nothing at this point. She sees the knife plunge in and out of the palms of her hands, over and over and over. But she can't feel it. He's trying to stab my neck. Only my neck. I don't have anything left. I'm at peace. I've had a wonderful life. I'm sorry, Roger. I love you. I'm sorry. With that, Mary succumbs to the evil that has entered her home and shattered the lives of her entire family on this day. She did everything in her power to try and stop it from happening. Mary Brumbeck, in her final act, did what she had done for the entirety of her life, for everyone in her life. She sacrificed. She gave all that she had to give, which in this particular circumstance was her life. But alas, in the end, even that was not enough. As darkness has prevailed, and both Roger and Mary Brumbeck's loving journey together through this thing we call life has come to an end. Only this journey ended in such a way that no one that knew them, that loved them, could ever have imagined, not even in their worst nightmares. The killer surveys the carnage that he has wrought in these people's homes on this beautiful Sunday. The warrior woman has finally been quieted. Her husband still appears to be breathing. The intruder walks quietly over to where the man lay, fighting to hold on. And he proceeds to finish what he came to do as he douses Roger Brumbeck's flame once and for all by slipping another blade from the Brumbeck's kitchen in and out of Roger's neck, methodically, time after time. Before leaving the house, he stops and looks at Mary Brumbeck's still body. He's still reeling from the fight she put forth. In his mind, he has a fleeting thought that she may be playing possum, that she may still be alive. She can't be, he thinks. Not after that. It's not possible. He walks towards the front door and stops in his tracks. He simply cannot shake the images of her tenacity, her resolve, her will to live. He walks back to Mary's body, which is laying face down on the carpet, and rolls her over to observe for any signs of life. There are none. As he skulks out of the home that he invaded and where he brought the worst havoc imaginable, the nagging thought, somehow, some way, Mary, still alive, persists in his mind, almost to the point of torture. We can only hope that Mary Brumbeck's indomitable will to live and that fight will continue to haunt the killer's thoughts and nightmares for the rest of his days. Rest in peace, Mary and Roger Brumbeck. Rest in peace. Now, Darren's going to want to end this episode after the final words there, but I'm going to insist that he keep going. So we both realize that the description of the murder of Mary Brumbeck was much more graphic than anything else that we've ever done on Defense Diaries. And as we said in the beginning, the intent was not to shock or sensationalize the act itself, but the entire intent was to honor and memorialize this heroic and brave woman. Her life was stolen from her. Her courage and will to live from the moment that I became a part of this case had an absolutely profound effect on me. And I have to be honest, even with as graphic as that description was, there is no true way to describe the level of violence that was present that day in the Brumbeck's home, and in particular with respect to the battle between Mary and the killer. The photographs of the crime scene and of Mary Brumbeck are the most devastating and heartbreaking images I've ever laid my eyes on at any point in my life or career. What stuck with me more than anything else is that a majority of the 50 plus stab wounds that she suffered were all defensive wounds. Both of Mary's thumbs were near amputation, meaning that she had grabbed the blade, trying with everything that she had to get it away from the killer. This wasn't a movie or some work of fiction. This was a 65-year-old woman, mother, a grandmother, who gave the piece of shit that killed her everything that she had and everything that he could handle. And I'd like to think that it was almost enough. Remember, she could have run out the back door or into her garage or into her car and tried to escape. But she made the choice to stay and fight in order to try to save her husband's life. Now, when we cover the autopsy in the near future, you will learn how it came to be known that Roger was still alive, yet incapable of helping his wife during her battle with the killer. Everything about what Mary did on that day and during her life make me feel nothing but incredible admiration for her as a human being. She's a shining example of what we should all aspire to be. Now, we have covered the brutal murders of five innocent people over the course of a 5.5-year period of time. Joy Blanchard, Thomas Hunter, and Shirley Sherman's all remain unsolved. Now, sadly, Mary and Roger Brumbeck's tragic murders must also be investigated. Will Omaha PD consider these murders to be connected to the Hunter and Sherman and Blanchard killings? Will they discover a link between the cases? Considering the brutal nature of the knife fight between the intruder and Mary Brumbeck, the killer must have left some type of forensic evidence, right? And remember, what you've just heard was the state's version of the timeline of the murders of Roger and Mary Brumbeck. Just to refresh your recollection, it's the state's contention that that fight, that nightmare, the shooting and stabbing deaths of those two innocent people happened approximately between 4:30 and 4:45 on May 12, 2013, which was a beautiful 70-degree day in which everyone in the world, including Omaha, was celebrating their mothers. There must have been a ton of neighbors that were home on that late afternoon who were grilling or enjoying the day in their backyards who had to have heard the gunshots and the screaming emanating from that crime scene, right? Well, all of these questions and more will be answered on the next few episodes of Defense Diaries. Before we let you go, we've got just a couple of quick announcements to make. Guess who's hitting the road? That's right, we are. And this time it's a doozy. We are joining a massive list of amazing pods on December 3rd in Hotlanta, the ATL, which is going to include Crime Lines, Already Gone, Cults, Crimes, and Cabernet, True Consequences, True Crime Cases with Lainey, Murder, She Told, Music City 911, Santa, Maybe a Criminal, Southern Gothic, Our True Crime Podcast, and Pretend, and I think maybe Corpus Delicti, I'm not sure. But this thing is going to be 3 hours long. It's going to be jam-packed with just all the true crime and wine that you could ever imagine. So come, join us for an incredible evening, and we're giving you plenty of lead time, so plan to join us. I think it might make a perfect Christmas gift or holiday gift for, that's right, you. The links for Tix, which are on sale now, will be in the show notes and on our socials at Defense Diaries on Facebook and Instagram and at Defense_Diaries on Twitter. Our patrons will be able to score discounted Tix with a discount code that will be applied at the time of purchase. So go ahead, support the show and get the perks. And also, one final announcement. As you guys know, we released an additional pod, which we originally called Sidebar. Well, we love the name so much that we failed to do the appropriate amount of research, and we are sad to say, by Law and Crime, no less. So, needless to say, we had to change the name. So, our pivot was to change the name to The Docket, as in a court docket. We will continue to give deep dive coverage of active and recent cases, as well as any breaking stories in the true crime world as they happen. So, keep your eyes peeled and your ears open for new episodes of that as well. Finally, we have some more shout-outs to some of our beloved patrons.
Excuse me, Bob. I'll handle this. Thank you very much. Thanks to Danny, Sarah B., Pat G., Lori D., Allie M., Nancy H., Sue M., Terry P., Wallace M., and Sandy N. Thank you so much for all of your support. To my forever plus one, Jilly, thank you. To my good friend, Mike K., thanks, buddy. Some of our newer patrons, Santana S., Glenda T., Sarah D., and Shondell W., thank you also. We really appreciate your support. It means the world to both Bob and me. So again, thanks.
And last, but certainly not least, to our glorious listeners, thank you for continually listening to our little pod. We just adore you, which, of course, we know you know, because we know you know that without you, I'd just be an old man talking about an old case. Talk to you next time.